My generation and the generation of older than I am are the last people who remember when Beverly Farms was the Gold Coast, mm-hmm. and when who had no stories about people who worked on the estates, mm-hmm. the ordinary people. Mm-hmm. And there was a man named Joe Garland who wrote a wonderful history of the wealthy summer community on the North Shore. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, he's written that book, mm-hmm. but nobody collects the stories and the pictures of working class people. Mm-hmm. So that became my goal. So I started...
Inside the city of Beverly, in Massachusetts, there is a distinct neighborhood called Beverly Farms. It's distinct because it's geographically separated, but it also behaves as an independent community. In this episode, we'll learn why Beverly Farms feels like an independent town and why its residents have a private beach. Nancy Coffey, our episode star, is a Beverly Farms resident, and she documented the stories of immigrant workers that lived in Beverly Farms back in the late 1800s and early 1900s. In her effort to document these stories, Nancy learned why Beverly Farms remain as an isolated community. Nancy is an adventurous and interesting woman, and at the end of this episode, she shared some of her adventures around the world before she married and settled in Beverly Farms. Hello, you're listening to Beverly Talks, the podcast about neighbors talking to neighbors. We're your hosts, Lucia,
Michael,
and Allison.
Yep, the same three from last time.
So who are we talking to or about today?
We're talking about Nancy Coffey.
Oh, Nancy.
You learned about Nancy before when we tried to record the first episode in your apartment.
Adventurous woman.
An adventurous woman, yes. But you cannot tell that at first. When I met her, she had, did I tell you? She had a cute pink cloche hat. Those old hats from the early 20th century, like the, okay. It's like bell shape.
Yes, yes.
Oh yeah, so like a flapper's hat, sort of.
Yeah, and she was wearing that kind of hat. And she's in her late 70s, I think. So it's hard to imagine that she had the adventures that she had. So we'll get into that later. Nancy Coffey, just to give more details on who she is, she's a Beverly Farms resident and she's known in the area for collecting stories from the immigrant workers that helped build all those beautiful homes in Beverly Farms back in the late 19th century and early 20th century. So I met her on May 3rd. We agreed to meet at the library, but because it wasn't open, we walked to the Beverly Farms Library. We walked to the bagel shop. I don't know if you've ever been. It's in front of the Beverly Farms train station.
A bagel shop I haven't heard of?
No, bagels.
Yeah.
I'll be there.
Now, something interesting about Nancy, like Michael was saying, she's an adventurous woman. Yes. But she's so lovely that it's you would think that she's just a lovely woman. But then the more you get to know her, she's so adventurous and courageous in all the things that she did, but also in the way she attempted to collect stories, just, you know, going to people's houses and interviewing. When I met her, did I tell you that she hugged me?
No.
We just met at the library and I was gonna shake her hand because that's what you do when you meet someone you don't know, but she just hugged me and said, thanks for doing this work. Aww. That's what she said first thing. So she's a lovely woman.
It makes sense, knowing, you know, what she does and how
that she interviewed people. Right. So she appreciates, you know,
capturing stories.
That's true. She appreciates oral history a lot. So
that she's was the trailblazer sweet. And you're the, you know,
the follower.
The legacy.
Okay. Let's listen to the first clip. It's her answer to my question of why she decided to dedicate herself into exploring the stories of immigrant workers. A little warning. There will be some noise at the coffee shop where we first met, but then we'll walk into the library and it's all quiet. So,
all right, my name is Nancy Coffey.
Get ready for some noise.
I was born in Beverly in 1940 and grew up in North Beverly when that was on Putnam Street, which at that time was a very rural area. Mm-hmm. Putnam Street was the last street before a big farm. Mm-hmm. And so that was a quiet neighborhood. After I was married, my husband worked in Lynn as a newspaper reporter. I was teaching in Boston. By the time we moved here, I had one child and I wasn't working anymore. So we were looking on the North Shore, and people laugh when I say the only house we could afford that met our requirements, which was it had to be near public transportation, was in Beverly Farms, because Beverly's Farms is supposed to be, you know, a ritzy area. And so I moved into what's very much working class housing in Beverly Farms. And when I was a history major in college, and I taught history. And when my kids were little, I started volunteering at the Beverly Historical Society, what's now called Historic Beverly. And when I was there, the woman who had been the curator for all her life retired, and they tried hiring someone, and she quit because the older woman was interfering with her work. And for quite a while, they didn't have any paid staff. So I was the volunteer curator of Cabot House, which is the headquarters, for several years. And the society had never had a changing exhibit. It was always just the stuff that had been there for, you know, a million years. So I did an exhibit. We did an exhibit on the bicentennial. And then, I think it was the next year, I said, you know, everything Beverly has ever done has been old Yankee. Beverly had a very lively Italian community. And I said, I want to do an exhibit on the Italian community. This was before computers were normal, before you could scan pictures, any of that stuff. So I got the local newspaper to help and local Italian community to help. And in the process of doing that exhibit, I got to know my Italian neighbors here in Beverly Farms and learned that there had been a shanty town out in the woods where Italian laborers lived, where one of my interviewees had been as a teenager. This was in 1906, 1907. So fast forward to 10 years ago, I was on Beverly's Open Space Committee, and there's a big open space property out here in Beverly Farms that's called Beverly Commons, and that's where the shanty town was. And I knew where it had been, and I knew there's a small building foundation out there, and I knew about that, and I knew they quarried out there and that they crushed stone out there. But I was walking out in that area with my husband and came across the remains of the shanty town, which were right adjacent to this other stuff, but in a kind of overgrown area. And when I did that, I thought, you know, my generation and the generation of older than I am are the last people who remember when Beverly Farms was the Gold Coast and who have no stories about people who worked on the estates, the ordinary people. And there was a man named Joe Garland who wrote a wonderful history of the wealthy summer community on the North Shore. And I thought, you know, he's written that book, but nobody collects the stories and the pictures of working class people. So that became my goal.
I think that's one of the reasons why I think she's such a cool person. Like collecting stories of working class people that that helped kind of establish this area, and they haven't really been remembered or honored up until her.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's great.
Yeah.
What a like honorable thing to do.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, I think the more types of people you kind of reveal have a history in a particular area could change people's idea of what the makeup of this particular area is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Know? Like those people's lives and stories weren't part of the overall narrative of Beverly Farms up until now.
Right. So what they created was, but not
right. Yeah.
Right. The people themselves.
And that they live in shanty towns, which sounds terrible in the winter to me.
Yeah. Shanty doesn't exactly give you a warm feeling.
There should be like a plaque.
Yeah.
Should be something. I wonder if there's anything out there to say, like, this was here.
Well, yeah. Somebody out there should make a plaque.
She's doing talks. She does a lot of talks about all this. But yeah, I don't know if there's a plaque. There should be for sure.
I think one of the local artists should gather up all those stones and create a community center with them.
Oh, like an artistic piece with all the pieces. Yeah.
A statue of somebody.
So while Nancy did research and interview the immigrants that worked in the late 1800s and early 1900s, Nancy learned why the neighborhood of Beverly Farms remained isolated for so long. So in the next clip, she explains what was the history behind this permanent disconnect between Beverly Farms and the city of Beverly.
Beverly Farms has always been an oddity in Beverly. It's always been a separate community. And in the 1880s, Beverly Farms tried to secede from Beverly. They didn't succeed in seceding, but there is still, well, I think they're pretty much gone now, but there are still people around who think they got cheated, that they should have seceded. They felt separate, and they were separate. Until there were paved roads, it was very, very hard, and until there were automobiles, it was really difficult to get from Beverly Farms to Beverly. It was easier to get to Manchester, actually, because if you think about it, when you drive down by Endicott, that's all cliff. And it was a very hard road. I don't think most of the people who lived here even had horses. You know, some of the farmers did, but not all of them. And they had a separate church. There was no, until the train came through in 1847, there was no, really very little communication with Beverly. There was a stagecoach that went to Boston once a day that came through, but I don't think, it was just a separate place. Mm-hmm. And then when the train came through and the summer people came, Beverly Farms wasn't the only place there were summer people. There were summer people in the Cove and some in North Beverly and along Lothrop Street, along the water. But these were rich people from Boston and some from Salem and other people who much more like Newport, but in a smaller version. And they were Boston aristocrats who built houses out here, and a lot of them still stand. And they started moving out here, not building anything ostentatious, but building summer homes in the 1840s and 50s, as soon as the train was came through. And then by the 1870s, they're beginning to build a lot more, and a lot more land was subdivided, and the summer community became more important. But they didn't want Beverly connected to Beverly Farms. Beverly was becoming an industrialized city. There were shoe factories were developing. There was a horse-drawn railway in Beverly. And the summer people didn't want that. They wanted a quiet, rural place where they didn't have to think about the city, but they could get on the train and go in when they needed to. And they did everything they could to keep Beverly Farms separate. And by the 1870s, this is after the Irish famine, which was in the 1840s, and by the 1860s, most of the hired help in Massachusetts was Irish immigrants. And so the summer people who came brought their Irish servants with them. But Beverly Farms also already had their own Irish population of people who were coming here. The first ones who came, well, that's all part of my book. Some of them came to work on estates, but one of them was a stonemason in his family. Another man, I don't know what motivated him to come here, but his name was Linehan, and he ended up developing, one of his sons became a stonemason. He did a lot of construction work. So these Irish people were doing the construction of estates. They weren't carpenters, but they were laborers and stonemasons. Mm-hmm. And so one of the talks I've given is how the Irish shaped Beverly Farms, because all of the downtown, all of the non-estate area has been very much affected by what the Irish did in the 19th century. So then in the 1880s, in 1880 when telephones came in, the farms, estate owners did not want the telephone lines to go by on their estates to Manchester and Gloucester, because it would affect the beauty of the place, and they prevented it. So Beverly Farms stayed isolated until the 1890s. They didn't have telephones. When the city wanted to extend the street railway to Beverly Farms, the wealthy summer people prevented it. So they were keeping it isolated. So by 1886, most of the economy really centered around the rich people. Most of the people who, there were only, I think, 10 small farms left. And the vast amount of the land was owned by the rich people by the middle of the 1880s. And so two wealthy men proposed that Beverly Farms separate. Beverly was still a town at that time, and towns could separate. Mm-hmm. And they persuaded the Beverly Farms people that this was to their advantage. Beverly Farms people had always felt like they'd been screwed by the city, or the main Beverly. That took them a long time to get a fire engine.
But it's all very interesting that this decision that's being made that's going to benefit a small amount of the population that lives there, but everybody else goes along with it because, you know, they're sort of dependent on those people.
Right. That was interesting.
But it's interesting that that decision might have prevented those, you know, Irish laborers from really moving on in their own lives, or, you know, getting services to that part of the area.
Right.
So, you know, it's like they're sort of forcing themselves to stay as, you know,
rural
servants in a rural area.
Yeah. Apparently they knew that the people they worked for were preventing the services from coming, but yet they still were like loyal to them, and many signed up petitions to be separate.
I wonder if it had to do with loyalty or with just like fear of losing their, you know.
Or who knows what benefits they promised. Like maybe they thought if, you know, they sign up.
Yeah.
But they hindered progress to keep it like this sanctuary for themselves.
Yeah. I know.
It's just too different. Like their perspectives are so different. Like the motivations for most of the homeowners there was aesthetics.
Yes.
Like keeping
and
it
peace,
pretty.
And keeping it peaceful too, because it's their vacation.
Right. But their vacation town.
Yeah. You'd think that the primary sort of reason to do or not do something would be like the overall effect of the town, and like whether or not we're going to be getting roads here seems a more impactful decision to have than, you know, is the power line going to ruin my view?
Right. No wonder. I mean, but
maybe
you
that's
go
just because we're poor. Can't think of the other perspective.
Yeah, I was thinking that. Yeah, but you go now and it's beautiful. I mean, it has remained an enchanting town. So I guess in a way it works. People that live there like it. So, well, something very enchanting about Beverly Farms is its private beach, West Beach. Let's dive into the next clip where Nancy explains how Beverly Farms ended having a private beach during the summer.
Because Beverly Farms has its own private beach, and that's another long story, but it was originally the rights to it. It's a very small section but that very small section was granted to one of the very early settlers in the 17th century. If he would maintain a causeway through the marsh to Manchester, which he did. And then eventually, so it was known as West's Beach, because his name was John West. Then it went to his descendants, and eventually, you know, practically everybody in Beverly Farms was related.
Yeah.
So then they became it was for the use of the people in the neighborhood. And in 1850, I think it's 1855, they were having fights about who getting the seaweed off the beach, because seaweed was an important fertilizer for the farms. So to settle it, they ended up incorporating as an association, the West Beach Association, which set the rules for who could get the seaweed and what they could do with it. And it's and that association is everybody who lives, I think the line of demarcation is right near the Pride train station. Mm-hmm. But that's who can go to West Beach. Mm-hmm. And it's a contentious issue.
Are we still fighting for seaweed today? Like, is it still an issue?
Yeah, how relevant is the seaweed issue?
I mean, I found it innocent that, you know, that the association was created to manage the seaweed. And I personally, I'm like, okay, that beach was meant to be private. And he shared with his community. So that's a lot of sharing from my point of view. But yeah, it's true. Not everyone can go there.
And nobody wants to go and pick the seaweed. They just want to go to the beach.
So it's still managed by an association, and the association is
still exists. But only when the seaweed issue came in, that's when they had to formalize the whole, if you live here, you can go kind of deal.
Okay. It's an explanation. I would personally like to enjoy the beach.
Yeah. Okay.
Maybe it could be like it's a timeshare thing. Give us 1 week out of the year.
Well, look, she does say it's open from September to Memorial Day for everyone.
It seems like an insulting compromise to make. Yes, we'll open it up to you, but only during the winter.
Well, from September to Memorial Day. Yeah. It's a mostly cold month. Yeah.
Well, little did they know how determined I am. A space heater and a blanket. I'll be there.
Yeah, so that was a beach explanation, which is better than no explanation.
Yes, it
is. Contentious beaches in Beverly.
Yeah. So, okay, we have covered mostly historical aspects or like contentious topics. Why Beverly Farms is separate from Beverly in many ways, physically, but also community-wise. Why West Beach is only available for Beverly Farms residents during the summer. But now let's get into this woman, Nancy Coffey. Mm. She has given like 17 unique talks about like history, like how the Irish shaped Beverly Farms, or there's one called Indoor Servants from the 1840s and 1950s. So she knows a lot of historical detail and she's a great storyteller. So
the first part of the interview happened at the bagel shop. And then Nancy and I walked to the Beverly Farms library so that we can talk in a quieter space. At the library, Nancy opened up a little more about her life and what about her past might have influenced her interest to collect all these stories from immigrant workers.
I think my parents were both very outgoing people and very friendly people who, you know, got to know their neighbors and got along well with all the neighbors. And I remember somebody came back from World War, probably from the Korean War, with a Korean bride. And somebody who was very racist or anyway, started going around to houses with a petition to get rid of these people. And I remember, I don't think they ever got to my house. I mean, a friend of mine's father and mother, his father was married. His mother was an Aleutian Indian, Aleut from Alaska. And Mr. McCausland was a big man. And whoever this guy was came to his house. I think Mr. McCausland looked at him and said, "Don't you darken my door again, and you get rid of that right away." But I remember my mother, who had never met this woman, they were two or three streets away from us, invited them to dinner, the Korean family. And, you know, that's what you do. You don't push people out. So I really grew up with that inclusiveness of...
Were both of your parents American?
Yeah, my father was... His family were early settlers, 17th century, and his family came from New Hampshire down here. My mother was from Illinois, and they met at the World's Fair in Chicago in 1933. Wow. That's another great story. But so my mother came here as an outsider.
Interesting. A brave woman.
She was, yeah.
Did you have kids, Sally?
Yeah, she had quite a time. But the curiosity and the interest in history, I don't know. I don't think that particularly came from my family. I think that was, and I think it's an interest that's developed. I think when I was a child, I don't think I had it. That I wasn't, I don't know if I've got a tissue or not. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. I do. I think I was a curious little kid. I wasn't necessarily interested in history, but I was, always wanted to know what was around the corner. And my parents encouraged our being adventurous. I was in one of the first Peace Corps groups, and people all said, I think maybe Peace Corps was 2 or 3 years old when I went.
Where did you go?
East Africa, Uganda. And people said, your parents let you go. I was old enough. I was an adult, but.
How old?
I was 25, I think. But when I was a kid, I had a rich aunt, whom I brought, my father's sister, and my cousin, not her child, but the daughter of one of my father's brothers, and her husband, I used to babysit for them. They were older. And they went to England for a few years to. Her husband was buying airplanes for an airline that doesn't exist anymore. And Shirley, my cousin, jokingly said, you'll have to come to England and babysit for us and come and visit. And my aunt was there, and she gave me the money to go. And so at 15, I went by boat to England by myself.
Oh, my God.
And the reason I went on that, I don't know why. I think going by boat at that time was cheaper than flying. And my father had a friend who was going to England on that boat. I think I saw him once on the whole trip. But
wasn't it scary for a young lady to be in a boat by herself?
No, it wasn't actually, because there were a lot of Irish families from the Boston area, none of whom I knew, going to Ireland. And two of the families had daughters my age, and so I hung out with them the whole time I was on the boat. But then I went, my cousin was supposed to pick me up at the port, and they were sick, so I had to get my way. And a taxi driver scammed me. He told me the trains were on strike or something. He was supposed to take me to the train. He drove me all the way there, which used all the money I had. But, I was 15. But then I went to Denmark by myself from England.
At 15?
At 15. I was almost 16, but I don't think I was 16 yet. Maybe I was 16.
But very brave.
That was brave. I had a Danish pen pal. One of my seventh grade teacher had gone to Denmark and set us up with pen pals, and I had continued to write to this girl. So I still remember. So I had to take a boat train and be overnight on a ferry, and then wound up in Denmark.
I love that story.
Yeah.
I'd be intimidated to do that now.
Yeah. Denmark, I don't know what I don't. If they don't have an English sign, I don't want to know.
I mean, not so much that, but just being alone in a country where you're effectively illiterate if you don't know the language, and that's tough for anybody to do.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you have to be very independent emotionally, because some kids at 14, 15 years old, they're attached still to their parents.
Yeah, and there's no cell phones or anything, so, you gotta...
Yeah, I know. I was very impressed when... you cannot see my reaction, but I was speechless. I was like, I was doing that. What? I couldn't believe it that she just said it, oh, yeah, I went to East Africa.
Oh, yeah. I was an adult 25. I was not an adult at 25, I think.
No way.
So, yeah. So it's funny, like, her voice, she's so, like, delicate, but then she's so adventurous, and you would not tell, yeah. I think, that she would just jump on a plane and go to East Africa, Uganda.
She's just very modest about it, too.
She is.
She seems more shocked that you're shocked. Or
yeah, yeah. Yeah, she seemed like, she just, I think...
You're like, that was brave. Yeah, I guess so.
I know. Very modest, that's the right word. Yeah, she's very modest.
Her parents, too, like to send a 15-year-old, you know, in a place where it's not likely she's checking in very often. Any number of things could have happened. And then she gets scammed.
Yeah.
And, my mom would be scared about me doing that today, and I'm 40.
Yeah, but the fact that you get scammed right off the boat and then still doesn't deter her from going to Denmark to meet a pen pal who could be, who knows what. Good for her. God love her.
So I kept saying, like, how could you do this alone? And eventually she's like, well, and then she started laughing because she remembered she traveled alone once and something funny happened. So that's the next clip.
I actually did do some traveling alone. But I think I had one experience when I think back on it. I think, what was I thinking? I stayed in Izmir, and I was staying with a girl who was teaching school there, who I'd known from somewhere, and she was busy during the day. So one day I went to Ephesus by myself on a bus, and that was fine. There were a lot of tourists there, and I got a ride home with somebody else. But then I also wanted to go to a place called, I'm going to forget the name of it, maybe I'll remember, but it was another ancient Roman site. And I had to take a bus to the city of Byblos. I went to Byblos, but I can't remember the name of the site. Anyhow, I thought I'd be able to walk to it. And I got off the bus, and there was nothing there. I mean, it was far. So a taxi driver came up, and I hired the taxi driver. So we're out in the middle of absolutely nowhere. You know, we were far from any civilization at all on this mountainous place with a huge Roman theater, and it had been a spa, you know. So he didn't know much English, but he was pointing things out to me and being kind of my tour guide. And then I can still remember, we're standing at the top of the hill, and he decides to give me a kiss. You know, this was before the days when I even thought of rape as a possibility. But I said no in every language I knew, and was sort of like this. And he could have raped me right there, and nothing would have happened. And he just sort of looked at me and said, "Meh," and then he just kept.
He kept driving.
No, we were walking. We were. But it was like, oh well, you know, I gave it a try. He wasn't a terrible person. Right. You know, he kept giving me my tour and took me back. But when I got home, thinking about it afterwards, I thought, my God, what kind of crazy woman was I? So I was, I guess I didn't know enough to be afraid. Mm-hmm. That was really what it was, too innocent.
Yeah, usually when you hear stories like that, they don't end with, I'll just move on.
I know. Yeah, that's why I have, thankfully, it was just a funny story. But
yeah,
like she said, what was I thinking? Yeah. Very adventurous. And I thought it was interesting that she eventually came here and had a family. And, you know, after traveling so much, she had a pretty settled life.
Did she continue traveling, or was it like this was a time in her life?
Yeah, she traveled, didn't continue traveling. And then she explained why. She said, like, they just didn't make a lot of money and there was no way they could do it. So even though they liked it. So this is the last clip. I thought it was just cute how she met her husband. Do you remember that?
I do remember this.
Yeah. Yeah, it was It was nice.
It was a computer date. Back when computers, you don't even know what these are, but the computer printers had a daisy wheel. It was like a little typewriter that typed, and so that's how we met. It was probably the first computer date company. It was called Datamate.
What? You would sign up someone to meet someone?
Yeah, but we didn't even have computers, so how did we do it?
I don't know. Where was this?
In Boston. It was called Datamate. Datamate, as in data. Uh-huh. Yeah. And then they sent you, I think Dan still has the letter sent from them with a list of women for him to call. And I would receive a similar list of the name of people. Isn't that funny?
This is blowing my mind.
How old was I? I was 25 or 26. I was 26. And I was unconnected to people, pretty much, because I'd been in the Peace Corps and just come back. Didn't know anybody. I don't think the bar scene existed much then.
And you were like, I have to meet someone? Or like, what made you go there?
Oh, I wanted to meet people. Yeah. I was working in a school. There weren't any other guys.
Right.
Yeah. Though there were guys, but I was teaching in high school, but I wasn't meeting anybody, so that's what I did.
And he had a list of women?
Yeah.
And he called you? How was that call?
Pardon?
He called you?
He called me. He was very funny on the phone. I think that's why I went out with him and married him.
What did he say that he was funny?
Oh, I can't even read. Oh. I think he said... I forget. It was some quote. He said, what the hell does that mean? And then he came out. I came to Beverly. I met him in Beverly. My parents were still living in here. And it was a restaurant in Beverly that was called the Commodore. So he came to Beverly on the train. And we went to the Commodore. And I remember it was snowing. My husband is Irish. Not Irish born, but his parents were from Ireland. He has very bushy eyebrows. And so when I met him, he had snow in his eyebrows, and I thought that was pretty cute. Anyway, that's another story. We're still married.
That was Nancy Coffey, people, with her some personal stories about her trips and how she met her husband.
Well, I looked up Datamate.
You did? Did you find anything?
I did. It was a bunch of things were happening around that time in 1966 because IBM created those kind of, you know, they call them supercomputers, but basically this giant room full of servers that can do like, you know, one calculation or something. So you would fill out a questionnaire and you would do it on, you would know it as a Scantron. Mm-hmm. Remember Scantron from schools where you'd fill in the little bubbles?
Yeah.
And they put it through the printout, or it would, you know, make
read
little
the
holes in it or something like that. And it would read the card and enter you into the database or whatever with other people that have answered the same questions, and then they would mail you the names and addresses and phone numbers of six potential mates for you.
Wow.
Based on the answers that you and the mates have given.
So this was probably one of the first successful marriages out of online dating, but not online.
Here's
but
the
first computer dating.
The logo.
I can't believe you found that picture. So Michael right now is showing me a picture he found online that says Datamate.
Data. Dear participant, below are the names of the people with whom your responses indicate you will be the most compatible. And then they give you a list of a bunch of them.
Awesome.
Come on, I'm an archivist. I can find anything.
You
Did
can
you get
find
a picture?
Anything.
Did they send you a picture of the person, or was it just...
I don't think you get a picture. No, it's just the names and addresses.
That's amazing what you just found.
And phone numbers.
Addresses and phone numbers.
That seems so creepy, right?
Yeah.
We cannot guarantee these results, nor can we endorse the characters of the individuals participating. We encourage you to contact these people, but suggest that you observe the normal precautions that you would before going out on a blind date.
Wow.
They're just slapping people together with no responsibility.
Cool.
So yeah, she was one of the few of... success stories adventures, in a fledgling industry.
And adventures again, entering this, like, I guess back then this was insane to just do a blind date with someone that a computer told you to meet.
Yeah, I bet coming from a computer, people were probably like,
what? Right.
Although, no, now that I think about it, like, people were, you know, all about the newfangled types of computer things in their home. You know, that's probably one of the reasons why they created that.
Mm.
Like, it used to be sort of in vogue to have a new piece of machinery or to find a way to use it to improve your life in some kind of way. So no, I bet it wasn't looked at like online dating is. I bet it was embraced. The only people that probably hated it were like the matchmakers losing their jobs.
Well, that was Nancy Coffey. I'm very thankful she spent so much time doing all these interviews, and now, you know, she can... My husband is from Irish family, so I know he would be interested in that talk about the Irish. Man. And you have Italian background, so I'm sure you would be interested about that Italian community. So
I want to find that shanty town.
Nancy Coffey did say that she could walk with us and show us where the remains of that shanty town are. So that could be an interview for next year. Thanks again, Nancy, for your time and dedication. And thanks for everyone who is listening. Happy holidays, and we'll come up with more episodes next year in 2020. Bye! If you like this episode or want to learn more about the neighbors living around you, please subscribe. We believe everyone is interesting and everyone has good stories to share. If you live or work in Beverly, please reach out to us at beverlytalks.com to schedule an interview. All unedited interviews will be permanently stored at the public library, and your friends and family members will be able to access them anytime in the future. And the music in this podcast was brought to you thanks to freesound.org. More details on the music credits will appear in our website. Bye!